Jeremy Renner returns to Paramount Plus for a brand new season of the original hit series, Mayor of Kingstown.
My job is to create a balance, avoid a war.
From executive producer Taylor Sheridan, co-creator of Yellowstone.
There's some new players in town, and they brought the flag.
And Antoine Fuqua, director of Training Day.
I know it's always been a war zone, Mike, but this is next level.
The mayor is back in business.
Are you warning me? You're going to find out.
Mayor of Kingstown. New season streaming June 2nd, exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Welcome back. Welcome in. This is Country Roads Confidential at earsports.com, part of the Paramount Podcast Network. I am Mike Casazza, welcoming in Chris Anderson for, well, it's a due edition of the Q&A. And Chris, in the spirit of jumping right into it, saving the time for subscriber questions and our answers, I will take the honors today and lead off with the first question.
Go for it.
This comes from I am MTN. This person says, curling my hair as if I had any. Do you all answer these questions?
Once a month or so, I guess, right? Is that about?
That's the A in the Q&A, sir. However, this is the last post on the board. It's shortly before you and I had this conversation on a Tuesday morning. I'm assuming he's new, although he's been here for 58 months, it says, with 162 comments. But yes, subscribers like you, I am MTN, ask questions. Chris and I answer to the best of our ability and knowledge. Sometimes one better than the other.
There we go. Well, we're already one for one right there.
Got one out of the way. It doesn't go in the mailbag, which follows this. We get through many of the questions. The best of the best are plucked from the pile. Chris asks, Chris and I answer, and then when we are finished, Chris comes through with the big broom, sweeps up the rest into a written version for people who don't like to listen to things. And since they're not listening, I don't have a lot of time for them. That's why you take care of it. Without any further delay, let's get into the edition.
Well, let's start with basketball, because we obviously there's been some news there with basketball, with the addition of Trey Mitchell, which we covered in our emergency podcast, which, by the way, I didn't go back and double check to make sure that we were relevant there since we pre-recorded that one. But hopefully we didn't have too many issues with things we said that might not have been relevant anymore. But I think we need to discuss it. And there were a lot of questions in there to indicate that we do, because the first one comes from Yidio 10, says, is the basketball team as currently constructed a tournament team? And if so, what seed do you envision for them? I'm not going to press you on the seed, Mike, but is this a tournament team yet?
I believe so. I don't see the flaws that I saw last year, which kind of pulled them down toward that, what, sub-500 record. I was probably higher on their offensive potential last year. I had questions about their front court and the potential relative to experience of a lot of the players that they were bringing in, and that would be Malik Curry, Polly Cap, Damone Kerrigan. And nothing against them, but it just seemed to me like they were being thrust into big spots that had to be really good. And they hadn't had to do that yet. And then pretty early in the process, Bob Huggins was kind of sour about that, saying these guys just come from lower levels and don't understand what it's going to be like in the Big 12. And what always struck me about that was they were like 11-1 and played pretty good basketball, you know, kind of blew one half against Marquette, but looked pretty good at times. And you're thinking, all right, this is going in the right direction. But that forecast from Huggins always stuck with me. And darn if it wasn't true. And then there were probably some locker room things, some COVID / injury things that interfered as well that you don't foresee, but you have to take into account as a possibility. And if I do that now, I see a lot of experience and I see people who want to be here and want to do this, which makes me less concerned about chemistry experiments. Can't know anything about injuries. I don't really believe that COVID will be a big issue. It really wasn't last year, apart from the one notable case. So you figure you clear out a lot of the junk from the crawl space and you can get through it without being as dirty. I just like their plan so far. I still don't think they're done, at least trying. We'll see about adding, but they've had a plan and they haven't stopped until they got it. And Mitchell was the big piece that they think that they were trying to build around. You had corner pieces and you had middle pieces that needed to attach to the edge to the middle. Now you have a centerpiece, I think, in Mitchell and some parts around him that make more sense. I don't know how they don't end up in the tournament based on what I see so far. Seed, who knows?
Let me follow this up with you. I agree with you. I do think it's a tournament team, but I think this is where I want to expand on this. At what point did your mind flip on if this was a tournament team or not? Like, was it Because I'm assuming that it wasn't, you know, as soon as the season ended, that next, you know, this coming year was going to be a tournament team. But did you start thinking this is a tournament team when they added Stevenson and Toussaint? Or was it not until after they added Matthews? Or was it not until after they added Mitchell? So at what point did your mind kind of flip to, hey, this might be a tournament team again?
This is kind of weird, but I always think that a Huggins team and a West Virginia team is a tournament team. Like, they're going to get a caliber of player and coaching that should get them there. And that happens far more likely than it doesn't. So when players start to bail and players graduate, okay, it's not necessarily like, man, they're going to stink. It's like, how is this picture going to look for a tournament team? And then, like, we've been consistent about talking about this. They were going to get experienced players from Power Five conferences, and they had to have, you know, one to two guards. They had to have one to two bigs, and they wanted a wing. And they went out and they got the guards, and you know, say what you want about Stevenson and Toussaint, but I think that fits what they want to do. You have guys who are eager and who want to make it work and who do want to be here. Toussaint's a really good example of a guy who's played competitively for good teams and wants a little more spotlight. That's okay. Stevenson fits in. I think he can do an impersonation of different needs for what the offense and the defense have. Matthews knows his way around here. I think he's a good glue piece. Wade and Bell seem like they're, I don't know. We'll see. But frankly, they don't have to be as great right now when you add Mitchell. Mitchell would be the one that made me put my feet in the wet cement, I guess, because I just think he's that type of a talent they can get right. They wouldn't do this at this point unless they've done their homework and they're sure they can get a waiver and that they're sure he can be a contributor. I'm sure there have been conversations with him and his people to make sure this is going to work. That would be the one that put me over the top. But I was always going in that direction. And really nothing they did made me say, uh-oh, step back, uh-oh, move to the side, let's see where this goes, because I thought they were going somewhere with this. They were going to keep doing things until the picture looked right, and they'd done that up until, what was that, Friday with Mitchell.
Right, and this was something, I'm in full agreement here, because this was something I talked about with the, I wrote a story, God, when was that? It was right after the season. It was a look back at Bob Huggins' history of quote-unquote fixing it, mm-hmm. and looking at the times that his team has finished under 500, and what happened in the year or two after that season. The first two times that happened to him wasn't his fault. It was his first year, I believe, at each of his stops in those instances. The second two times were his two times under 500 at West Virginia. This would be his third. And both times there was tremendous turnover in the offseason, but not in a bad way, almost like in a pruning. Like, I'm not meaning this negative towards anybody that has left the program, but like pruning some of the bad limbs, the dead limbs, and trying to let new growth come in and adding new pieces. And I think that's pretty much what he's done. Again, like some pieces that left were good, but I think they brought in some new life and some better pieces that might make this a more well-rounded team, and one that's going to play his style and get them back into the tournament, because this is what he does. When things don't go right, it's, all right, scrap it, let's start over. And tries to start over by doing the, not starting over, literally from the ground up, but with new players that are experienced and can handle it. So I'm with you. I think this is a tournament team. I think this is something that you and I have been predicting he would be doing, a massive overhaul with experienced players. And here we are, and maybe not done, which leads us to the next question. If not Courtney Ramey, the other Texas transfer, then who, if anyone, is there someone else we're targeting, or is it Ramey, or sticking with what we've got, from Captain Earfan 3?
I have two for this. I don't know if you want to go first, because you might have two better ones or the two right answers. I'm not sure.
Oh, you know, mine are never better than yours, Mike. Go ahead.
I've been obsessed with David Roddy for a while. And I know he's 6'6", 255, 260. And that may not scream guard. He's a guard. And he's just unlike anybody else. And if you look at their roster right now, like, that's a part that, again, few teams have, but you can make room for a guy like him. That's like, they could be small in the backcourt. And you're talking Kedrian Johnson, Joe Toussaint, Eric Stevenson, although he's not, like, I wouldn't call him short or squat, but he's not 6'6", 255, right? And Roddy's a guy who shot a very high percentage from three last year. He's averaged about three assists across his career. He handles the ball. They list him as a forward. He's a guard, or at least he's guard capable. He could play two. He could be a third guard. He would be a matchup nightmare. Trouble is, he's probably a first round draft pick, and it's not a given that he's going to be available. He's had his options of, I might go pro, I might go to the portal, I might come back. It's awful late in the game. But I just always seen him, and if you haven't looked at him, look at him. David Roddy, Colorado State, just a unique player. There's no one like him, and I just think that he creates a lot of problems. Like, does West Virginia have problems? Yeah, maybe. I'll get to one in a second. But he causes problems, and you're going to have to match up with that, and good luck. He's a bull who can shoot and pass and handle, and I've just liked him for a long, long time. And then just kind of a weird thing, like we're one piece away, Chris, from completing the offseason for West Virginia. And you would say it's a player or a position, maybe not you specifically, though perhaps you would. But all I need, Chris, is excuse me, let me crack my knuckles here. Crane my neck. Guys are making shots. And like, I feel Umoja Gibson's out there and can do some backcourt things, could be on the ball, could be off the ball, and he's just offense off the bench. He can come in and hit four threes and a half for you. He could hit a couple of threes in like a 10-0 run. And I think West Virginia's people know his coach from UNT. They obviously know him from Oklahoma. I don't know why he's leaving Oklahoma, except that maybe he wants to do more than what I just described. But you're looking for a shooter who's still out there who would know the Big 12 and who could step in that the Mountaineers know. That's awful intriguing to me. I don't know that there's an option for West Virginia in either one of those cases. I don't know if they're really looking hard at other people right now. And I could see them not adding Ramey and then not adding anybody. But again, I've been just eyeballing Roddy for a long time. And Gibson just seems like that would be seamless in some regard if they wanted to do it, they being both of them.
Yeah, nothing. I love the Roddy pick. I don't know West Virginia's interest, but I love the I like that type of player. I mean, a 250-pound guard. Like, I know Likely's not that big, right? The kid from the young man from Oklahoma State. But I like the idea of having that big, thick guard that can essentially overpower and big boy other guards, that can get in there and get dirty in the paint, can grab rebounds, and can help out your forwards on the glass. So I really like that pick of yours there. But no, I haven't heard anything specific about, you know, is it Ramey and nothing, or Ramey and then somebody else behind that? Who knows? But I wouldn't be surprised either if it's no Ramey and no nothing. And they just say, hey, did a good job. Let's move forward. Mm-hmm. NC Wayward Ear. Again, related. Let's pretend like there's no Ramey. I mean, because there's not right now. With the current basketball roster, who is your starting five and first three off the bench, and why? What you got?
This is you, because you like to do the finishing five first. at least as like a priority, which I get. But let me see where you start, because I have my five, and my three here is kind of fuzzy, because I don't think that they're going to have three necessarily, because I think that that bench could really fluctuate based on matchups, which is the point of having the complexion that they have right now.
Okay, let me ask you this before I get my starting five. The all four transfers are in the starting five. True or false?
I'm not sure about Toussaint.
Okay.
That would be the one that I'm not sure about.
And I'm with you. I feel like that's a Toussaint, KD kind of, hey, whichever way it goes. You know, one's a starter, one's not. They play similar minutes, and then you figure out who's playing the best, and that person closes, or try them both out with the quote-unquote closing five for the first couple weeks, or maybe in the first month, all of non-conference play, and then stick with whatever works best the rest of the way. So I'm with you on that, because, yeah, I was thinking Matthews, Mitchell, Stevenson, starter, starter, starter. And then I was torn between Toussaint and Keedy. And then it gets interesting for me.
This is where Mitchell comes into play as like a connect factor.
Right. Like, am I going with another guard a guard, a wingish kind of guy? Am I going with like shooting with Jamel King? Am I going with another guard, a bigger guard that can, you know, do something in Kobe Johnson? Or am I going with another forward and going with Okonkwo, who, for those who don't remember, I mean, Bob Huggins was talking him up as the most athletic big they had on their team, that he was the guy that could get up there and rebound, the guy that could do all of these things that no other big on their roster could do last year until he got hurt. Now, how much of that was coach speak? How much of that was, you know, the truth? I think I'm leaning more towards the truth because I don't think Bob Huggins is too big on coach speak. And I know a little bit, all of them are, but do you go Okonkwo? You got Stevenson, Keedy, Stevenson, Matthews, Okonkwo, Mitchell Okonkwo, however you want to put it.
Yeah, so that's the thing here now, too. Are they a two guard with, I just have a hard time thinking he's not going to start Keedrian and Johnson for him coming back. And then I would assume having a good offseason in Tucson's kind of a cusp to doing whatever it takes coming off the bench. Tucson can play more, and I don't think he'll care if he starts or not. But I would see Keedrian Johnson, and this is where things get interesting. Their 2-3 combination. Is it the point and then Stevenson Matthews? Is it the point Kobe Stevenson? Is it the point Seth Wilson Stevenson? Like, Stevenson's 6'4 and is an older guy who knows how to probably play bigger than he is, and he can probably mix match a little bit. He could play like the 2/3. That's interesting to me. And then, irrespective of that, 4-5. Is Matthews a 4? Is he a 3? So if you go two guards, Matthews can play 3, and then you're big, because now your 4-5 could be Okonkwo, Mitchell Okonkwo, whatever, or Mitchell Wague.
Yep.
Because Mitchell does have that 6'9", 220 to him. He's not 250. You know, he's 220. And unless he balloons and has muscles and mass that he hadn't had before, at least recently, like, that's a guy who can play 4. And now if you're 3, 4, 5, are Matthews, Mitchell Wague, Matthews, Mitchell Okonkwo, that's pretty big. That's pretty cool. And you might be able to get away with a smaller backcourt. And then if you're 4-5, if your 4-5 is dependent on the opponent too, you know, you could do Matthews, Mitchell. You could do something even more traditional if you're going to keep Matthews as a 4. But, you know, Mitchell does give you some flexibility. So does Matthews. A 3, a 4, a 4, and a 5. I just see like a need for defense. And I just wonder about like a traditional backcourt and then a 3, 4, 5 of Matthews, Mitchell, Wague, Matthews, Mitchell, Okonkwo, some type of that where they have some size. And, you know, Wague is kind of an eraser-ish guy. I know that we mentioned this before, but like a little bit like Tariq Owens at Texas Tech and St. John's a couple years ago. But if you go Matthews, Mitchell, Okonkwo, you're looking at 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", guys who can probably handle their feet around the perimeter and in the post and switch and do some different things. That's kind of intriguing too. And that leads me to the question about the defense and what they're going to do. There's options. I just see like a 1-2 with the point in Stevenson and then kind of a big 3, 4, 5 that can move around and do some things.
I'm with you. I think
the point here is there isn't one answer, I don't think.
I don't think it could so be either. Different. I was going to say, and Huggins is not one to really swap the lineups around a lot once the season starts. But so I think whatever you see towards the start of the year will probably be it. But I'm not sure there'll be an answer until the start of the year, because I'm with you. Do you go 3-guard? You got Matthews at the 4. You got Matthews at the 3. However you want to do it. I think there's some flexibility, and that's a good thing. And I think you're going to see it swap around a lot in the game, but maybe not like for the first, you know, 5 minutes of the game, because again, over the years we've seen him, like, for instance, start a guy, play him like 5 minutes, and then that's essentially it for the game. They're not, you know, play 10 minutes or so for an entire game, but he's a starter, so he's not afraid to do that. So I think he'll find his 5 and flex it around as the game goes on to figure out what's best.
Yeah, and then your bench is going to fluctuate too. I would think that if Tucson doesn't start, he's probably a bet to be a very reliable 6-man, just in the fact that that's a guard who wants to come in and figure out, okay, they can't guard the perimeter, I'm going to drive, or, you know, they can't work a pick and roll, I'm going to maneuver around my bigs and try to get something to happen. I think he can do that. That's a good bench guy to me, I would think. Whereas Keedrian would be fine for defense, and maybe if he gets his head down and learns how to score and get to the foul line. That might be good too. I have no problem penciling them in as an early sub. But after that, you know, what does the game dictate? Do you need like an Okonkwo to come in and grab rebounds and maybe to stretch a little bit? Do you need a Jamel Cain to come in and hit some threes? Do you need a Seth Wilson to come in and hit some threes? Does Kobe have to come in and settle things down and try to get the offense going and do the things he did last year, where he was a pretty productive part of a number of good player combinations and lineups? Because, you know, he kind of understood for a freshman how to fit in, and can he do more as a sophomore who knows more and knows more about fitting in? They're gonna have some options on the bench if they're refined and know their roles and their purpose, that you can maybe avoid some of those situations where you're caught on the floor with bad lineups and you get like a 12-2 run put against you.
All right. Moving on to the next question. This one from Dan Proud. Kind of help us transition from basketball to football, because it's a two-parter. Let's do the basketball part first. Who is the next assistant coach to get a head coaching job? And he gives football and basketball. Basketball being Larry Harrison or Eric Martin.
Eric Martin.
Okay. This is not in it, you know, when I read this, I said, wow, what a podcast bait question. What a bait question. And then I thought about it. And I said, the answer is obviously this. And then I thought, well, maybe not. Maybe it's this. And then I thought, well, that's a pretty darn good question, actually, because I think there is some debate about which way you would go. Larry Harrison being, I guess, the more senior of the assistant coaches on Bob Huggins' staff, or at least out of these two here that we're talking about. He's been linked with a couple head coaching jobs, but so too recently has Eric Martin. So I think it depends on which job in particular opens up, because either one of those could end up with a head coaching gig in the next couple years. So I'm not sure which way I was leaning. I went back and forth on both of them like five times after seeing the question.
I think Eric has some momentum recently from his traction with the Cincinnati job. He'll get support from people he played with who are still recognizable, and also like a lot of that stuff where he's been on, you know, the top 40 under whatever list. I'm not sure he's under 40 anymore. Maybe I should know that. But Larry's been around for a while, but he's also been on the bench here for, I mean, literally since day one. And I can only remember one, maybe two jobs that he was deep in, and they were not high profile jobs, but he makes good money here and has a good rapport with Huggins, and he might be here. We'll see.
Football side of things. Same question. Graham Harrell or Jordan Leslie?
I just think Leslie, because I think he was close to the Troy job. And there might be an argument about, well, you know, a lot of these schools are picking offensive coaches. Well, Troy almost picked a defensive coach and ultimately picked a defensive coach in John Sumrall. Sumrall just has a little bit higher profile than Leslie right now. But if you look at Leslie's arrow pointing up in that direction too, certainly too, it would be the right situation for him to move, I think, before Harrell, who is a more renowned, albeit like younger and in the game, I think, because he's only been around for a couple of years, you know, three at SC, three at North Texas, two at Washington State. But you look at his playing experience, high profile NFL experience. Listen, he was not a high profile player in the NFL. He was in some situations that certainly account for something. But then again, Leslie, his career is mostly in junior college until hitting Troy and West Virginia. So it's not like he's, you know, gray in the hair, long in the tooth, too. So they're both kind of young guys who have some time. They're going to have to get, like, I think, entry level spots. But I just think that a guy who can recruit junior colleges, knows the defense, don't have to worry about that, and can get himself around some good offensive coaches. I always think that there's like a lean about that from administrators and ADs about it's easier to find offensive coaches who can complement a defensive minded head coach. And you have like this concern about putting an offensive guy in charge and complementing your roster and your game plan with defensive staff addition. That's not to say Harrell can't do it, but I think a knock on a lot of air raid and then Mike Leach, whatever label you want to put it, I think a knock on that sometimes that they're so hyper-focused on offense, they overlook defense. And sometimes that can be a drawback too. Whereas conversely, Leslie already knows the defense. And if he's going to let somebody run the offense, he's going to delegate and he's going to hire an offensive coordinator. He's going to do that stuff. Now you're going to have two roundabout sides that are going to be, you know, led by someone devoted to just that cause. That said, Harrell will be in the lead, I would think, but I also wonder about what head coaching job he wants to take. Leslie's time is probably coming. I think he wants to do it sooner than later, I would imagine. But Harrell may be a little bit pickier too, because he's moved around a bunch. And, you know, sometimes these guys that do that, they're just seeing these offensive savants, but what have they done? Until they get in that head chair, it's hard to know. But they want to make sure that they take the right seat at the right table so that this doesn't derail. And all the I told you so's out there, they don't get a chance to come up and say, I told you so. So he might delay it a little bit on his own, whereas Leslie might be ready or might be given a chance sooner.
Yeah, I think Leslie's recent success at West Virginia, his ability to make that quick transition to full-time defensive coordinator, you know, with everything that happened that summer, and all of a sudden he's thrust into the lead gig there. And then over the past few seasons has, you know, a lot of turnover on that defense, and just kind of rolled with it and still put out a solid product each and every season. He has put out a defense that can help you win games each and every season, despite all the turnover, despite all the young guys, despite all the coaching changes on his staff, and has done that job. And I think that is what's going to make him more enticing, his ability to adapt and adjust like that. And he's already done it. Will entice more people. Cause yeah, I went through the same thought process as you mentioned a minute ago of, yeah, it's gotta be Leslie. And then it's like, well, I mean, offense wins football games right now. I mean, they have the data to back it up that even teams like Alabama are putting more focus on offense than they are defense. So maybe because of that trend, Harrell ends up getting the job first, but I'm still leaning towards Leslie just because of his ability to adapt. And like you said, you have him just adapting and doing everything on defense, and then he can go find that offensive savant to help carry that side of the ball.
I like it.
Next question. What one thing, other than the move to the Big 12, do you think has had the biggest impact to WVU sports in the last decade? That's from the Big Dude.
There's low-hanging fruit here, like NIL and transfer immediate eligibility and things like that. I thought about this one, and like the first answer that came to my head has been a topic lately, and I was like, well, that can't be it, so I backed off a little bit. So I'll give you my runner-up. The bond for construction for facilities is a really big deal. That let them plant some seeds and put up new stuff and improve stuff all over the athletic campus, and that's a big deal because their facilities were trailing. We've been over this before. Like, they had the worst football facilities. That's a bad thing if you're in a Power 5 conference. I'm not sure they still have the worst, but, like, if they're 10th or 9th, they're way closer to 1 than they ever were before. They don't have the nicest. They don't have top half nicest. I know that. But, like, the gap was such that it was not good. And when you won't take recruits to certain parts of your athletic campus because of the comparison they're going to make to places they've been or will be to, that's not good. You don't hear that anymore. So the bond and the way for them to fund stuff, that was a huge deal. So that would be a big one for me. My pick with that would be baseball and just the commitment to baseball. That means salaries. That means agreeing to fully fund scholarships. That means paying assistant coaches and all that stuff. And the head coach should keep them here too. The stadium, and granted, that's financed by tax increments, but it's still financed. They had to have a plan. It bridges the off season from, you know, basketball to football. And if you have year round fans for a college campus, that's a big deal because college campuses are more about your relationship with the school and the athletic department necessarily than players. It's more about your relationship being a fan, you know, going to games, concessions, the experience, because those players are going to cycle through. I was going to say every 4 or 5 years, but that's not even true now. But your time going to the game is the same. It's a routine. You tailgate, you know, you get up at a certain hour, you tailgate, you watch the game, you tailgate again, you go to the hotel, you go home, and you do that again and again and again. And then, like, when you hit that dry patch after the basketball season, well, if things aren't going well, or if you're busy or whatever, you might not come back in football, or you might not do basketball. If you have that bridge from one season to the other, and it's, like, a quality bridge, like, the baseball team has been good, and it's fun, I think that keeps your fans engaged year-round. That's good for fundraising. That's good for renewing season tickets. That's good for our next generation of fans because baseball fans are younger. Like, they go to the games because there's cotton candy and peanuts and Cracker Jacks and things like that. Well, they grow up And a challenge for college sports right now is having next generation fans, because certain people time out. They get older, or they have kids, or they move away because they're not on their college campus anymore. But you got to replenish that. And the more active you are and the more successful you are in keeping fans engaged year round, the more likely you are to replenish your fan base. So that's a cool thing, I think. And it's probably starting to pay off now, because attendance of baseball has been pretty solid for a couple of years. Has it made season tickets in football better? No, that's not happening anywhere. So maybe the drop off hasn't been as severe. But now you're also seeing like people who are more engaged in baseball, and then as such in WVU, well, does that help when the volleyball team is good, or when women's basketball is a new coach and they want to get attendance up? Does it help with wrestling matches? Does it help with soccer matches? Yeah, it does. Because now you're part of the fan base. You're not a fan of football. You're not a fan of basketball. You're a fan of West Virginia. This probably isn't at the finish line yet, but I think that was a goal. And to see this so far down the line right now, I think what, 10 years, it's a pretty big difference, I think, when you step back and look at what it was and what it is, just for all the fan bases. And the one thing that's really changed is baseball, because they invested in it. They made it a pastime, forgive me. But by doing so, they accomplished other goals, which was to get fans more involved more frequently. And then, you know, once you get inside, you look around, you're like, well, hey, this is fun. Let me go to a wrestling match. Let me go to a volleyball match. Let me go to a soccer match. So maybe imperceptible, but to me as a reporter on these things, that's a noticeable difference for me.
I like the big picture look to the health of the ecosystem, if you will. Yes. I think that's the right answer. I'll take the other angle and go more big money sport specific and its impact as it rolls around. And I think I'm going back to, it's going to be oddly specific, but the fourth quarter of the 2018 game against Oklahoma State. Because mm-hmm. we're talking the last 10 years. So this goes back to 2012. Now, 2012 could have been a tremendous year, but I mean, there's no one specific game. I mean, the Texas Tech game, I guess you could say, but really the whole thing went off the rails for the second half of the season. But you look at that Oklahoma State game in 2018. West Virginia is ranked inside the top 10 at the time. They are one of the teams that everyone's talking about. I mean, they were literally in like the you know, college football playoff ranking things that they were releasing, the rankings that they were releasing. And if West Virginia wins that game, they are automatically in the Big 12 championship game, no matter what happens in their final game of the season against Oklahoma. No matter what, they are in the Big 12 championship game for the first and, as of right now, only time ever. Instead, I think it was a 93-94% chance, like looking at those, you know, ESPN in-game win probabilities. They were up two scores in the fourth quarter, and things just fell apart. They couldn't stop anybody. They couldn't get first downs all of a sudden. And that was when it kind of just, like, went sideways. And once that happened, they lose that game. Then they have to win Oklahoma, but they don't. They lose that one in the last second. They're out the Big 12 championship game. Instead of Will Grier throwing passes to David Sills and Gary Jennings in the Big 12 championship game and a big extension for Dana Holgorsen, it's Jack Allison throwing passes to Quincy Hall in the Camping World Bowl against Syracuse. And that's the end of the Dana Holgorsen era.
Yeah, that happens.
I mean, I don't want to say that you win that game and all of a sudden Dana's still around, and then none of whatever happens the last 3 years happens, and this team gets back on track in a different way. And, you know, I don't know. But then it ends up with everything happening with Holgorsen leaving and then him ending up at Houston, and all of a sudden Houston's back, and then Houston's in the Big 12 now. I think there's a lot of dominoes from that one loss right there at the end of 2018, a game that a lot of people just kind of forget about, when that was extremely impactful.
That would be the micro, right?
Yes.
I like it. That's a good one, too. I mean, that's a specific one that sticks out to me as well. It's like a moment, a game, an interchange in the path, and that's an impossible one to ignore.
One of those sliding door situations, you know, one slide open one way, a whole new timeline, if you will.
Yep.
Speaking of new timelines and sliding doors, this was you and I both picked this one out to answer on the pod. And maybe, well, do you want to end on this one? I was going to end on this one unless you had something else you want to talk about. This is the national championship question.
Go for it.
Okay. What would have, this is from GA Mountaineer 15. What would have been more important for the WVU football team's trajectory and why? Winning the 88 or 2007 national championship?
07. Next question.
Good. Good. Oh. So it's no question to you.
I just think where we have come in 15 years since then, and you look at what happened from college football from what 88 to 2007, it's the last 15 years run laps around the 19 before it, just in the way that the game has evolved and the way that the money has progressed, how different, never mind the product on the field is when it comes to speed, size, scheme, and the diversity of each and how capably that diversity can be organized and applied on offense, on defense, on special teams so that unique and different can be good and can be effective. And if it doesn't look like what it looks like on the other, by the way, two or three channels, right? Back in the 80s, it's going to look like and be more successful or less successful than what's on the other 7, 8, 9, 12 channels, right? So it's just so much bigger and more vast and more diverse, but also more entertaining and more lucrative now than it was 15 years ago. And the growth, I think, far exceeds what happened in those same parameters between 88 and 2007. So that's number one. Like, you're going somewhere when you win a national title in 88. You're going somewhere when you win a national title in 2007. If you win it in 07, you're much more prepared for now. And this just seems like it's evolved in such a way that it's going to continue like this a little bit, but you'd be much better off winning it now than you would have 19 years ago because you probably navigated the changes and maybe even led the changes. And particular to that, who was doing different better than West Virginia in 2007? Nobody, right?
Right.
Yep. And you had a guy who would not have left had he won the national title. I don't think it might have been a couple years later, but he gets a big contract and all those things we talked about, like having to invest in baseball to make other sports better, having to have bonds to build stuff and refurbish stuff. That stuff comes sooner and quicker when you have a national championship football program. And that wasn't the case in 1988, because the business was different. You needed those things, but you didn't do it with the same motivation or the same ease, the same logic or the same, you know, it is what it is. That's how you have to do it as you would have in 2007, never mind today too. So just the fact that you probably keep your coach who was a bit of a visionary and doing different better than everybody else. And then if you take the program that does more with less and you give them more, there's a lot of potential there that probably takes you into the next generation and takes you further than a similar or parallel or identical conquest would have taken you in 1988.
All right. I think I'm with you. Yeah. I had a little bit more uncertainty about it, a little bit more inner debate, inner dialogue about it. Cause I tried to think back in 1988, I was only four. So I don't remember the landscape of college football at the time. But I was trying to think of what that had to deal with as far as timing on conference changes, conference realignment, TV deals, because some of these teams, as we've seen over the years, and it's more than just a one-off, I think, because, I mean, Washington won or claimed half a title, and nobody cares about them. Colorado claimed half a title. Georgia Tech claimed half a title. Nobody cares about them. No offense to those programs, but, like, that was around that time, you know, right around 1990, I believe it was Colorado, right? And that doesn't hold up. People don't think, hey, national champion Colorado in 2022. That's not how people think right now. So that wouldn't stick like I would. Like some of the, because we give teams a hard time, like Pitt, for instance. Now, they have this vast history of college football, but so much of it happened so long ago that no one should care, but it still helps hold them up in the world of college football. No one would ever think of, not including Pitt, for instance, in, you know, if the top teams separated. Like, yeah, Pitt's in, of course. And so I think if you have that national championship in your back pocket early on, you can hold on to it. But I guess that would be even more true if it happened in 2007. And I don't know if there were that many changes coming to realignment, because I think West Virginia was independent in 88, right? Like, they didn't join the Big East until a couple years after that. And that might have already been set in motion even before that national championship game. So I don't think that would have had an impact. But that's where I was going. That's the only reason I had a debate. I didn't want to make a quick answer, because my quick answer was 2007, just like you. Like, no doubt, not even a question. But I wanted to think more about the conference realignment, the TV deals, establishing a blue blood, a light blue blood, a teal blood legacy, like way back, you know, like some of these programs have. But I just don't think it sticks if it's a one-off type of thing. You have to do it a couple times. And if it's just 88, that's just once, and people forget about it eventually. So yeah, I think 2007, with how drastically things have changed in the last 15 years, as you noted, it would be far more impactful. Keep Rich Rodriguez around longer. You get another year of Pat White, Noel Devine all together in 2008, you know, the following year. I don't know if you're running it back, but you're going to have a lot of publicity around that. And all of a sudden, if you're running it back with a national championship team coming in likely with a top 10 ranking, your coach back on a big new contract extension, Pat White, Noel Devine putting up ridiculous numbers, then all of a sudden that snowballs into getting some big time recruits, because you're like, holy cow, look at these guys doing it again, and they're crazy, and this offense is awesome. And yeah, you know, maybe it snowballs into something else that's even better. And maybe West Virginia is getting that look into the ACC instead of the Big 12, and so on and so forth. So I'm with you. 2007 is the answer.
88, they go 11-1. 89, 8-3. 8-3-1. They're pretty good. 4-7, 6-5, 5-4. If you win a title, do you get a recruiting bump back then that carries you much stronger through 4-6, 6-5, 5-4-2?
I don't know if you do as much then as you do now.
Correct. And then my point there being 07, 11-2, 9-4, 9-4, 9-4, 10-3. Pretty good.
You might legitimately win another. If you win a title in 07, it might prompt you to, and Rich Rod sticks around, because I think we all agree that the issues with those, especially the 2010 team, was the offense had stalled out under Jeff Mullen. Mm-hmm. If you keep that defense, which I think it was the 2010 one, was like one of the best ever for West Virginia as far as statistically. And you put it with a Rich Rod offense, I mean, you're not going to have Pat White that year because he would have already graduated. But still, you might end up in, I guess it's not BCS, whatever the top bowls were at the time, again and again and again. Like, and then all of a sudden you have, what, like 4, 5, 6 BCS bowls in like an 8-year period?
Yeah, you don't have like UConn representing
UConn. Right. Exactly. You're not losing to Syracuse 10-7 in the Carrier Dome or whatever it was.
You're not putting a new coaching staff in 2008 that says we're going to win games, you know, 20-13. We're going to be balanced. We're going to strive for, you know, run pass splits and run pass yardage and all that stuff. No, you're going to have a guy who's going to keep his foot on the floorboard and try to play like his hair is on fire. And it would have kept going. And you're right. So like those thin years after the 88 appearance, and they do get back, by the way, the number I didn't mention was that they got back to at least the stage, around the stage for the national championship conversation in 93, right?
Yeah.
Has not happened here since then, but pulled the rug out after that 07 season. And if the rug is still there, you got your foot and you probably go somewhere. And you're right. They're probably in that conversation because like the Big East was still around for a couple of years and they were still getting the BCS bid. So you're going to be in those high level games. And then who knows how many Big East games you're losing if you're winning a national championship and recruiting to that. Like, how many Big East games are you winning? You're definitely the number one recruiting class in the Big East year after year after year, right?
Yep.
I just, because a lot of players are like, wait a minute, I can get to a BCS game and be in a national championship conversation every year by signing at West Virginia instead of, I don't know, LSU, Florida State, whatever, who might have been the competition for services back then in a more powerful conference. I think that would have been influential. And hearing you talk, that's a dynamic that I think did not exist in 88. That's not like a logic exercise that players went through, where now they do, because that's what recruiting is. Recruiting is so much more different now than it was back then, too. And it's such a key that I just think you're better served by winning one in 07.
Well, I'm glad we've come back around and agreed on something again.
Good time to finish.
Yeah, it is. Agree? And for the rest of the questions, again, I will tackle those in written form. I will post those. Let's see, it's Tuesday morning. I'll probably post them Wednesday morning, the rest of the questions, and those will be there for everybody to read, including questions on Batman movies. I believe somebody asked me to list every single leader in each statistical category and name every Big 12 award winner. So I'm going to have my work cut out for me on the written form.
Be a long one, but a good one.
Yep.
Much like this podcast.
As always.
Until next time, I'm Mike Casazza.
And I'm Chris Anderson.
We will talk to you later.
Greetings, Fantasy Warriors. I'm Heath Cummings, your guide to fantasy dominance on FFT Dynasty. Join me this offseason where mock drafts become epic showdowns and every pick shapes your legacy.
If I was Adam, with the team that he's built, Will Levis makes so much more sense.
And that's not all. We're peeling back the curtain on the future with our exclusive 2024 NFL Draft Prospect Profiles. Uncover hidden gems that'll elevate your roster to legendary status.
Puka Nacua. After Cooper Kupp, we really have no idea who's going to get the targets.
Keaton Mitchell of East Carolina. Explosive speed is ridiculous.
This isn't just a podcast. It's a playbook for champions. Subscribe to FFT Dynasty now, and together we'll conquer the fantasy football frontier. Your dynasty journey starts here.